Welcome to the Bureau Briefing, a podcast by the Bureau of Digital, an organization devoted to giving digital professionals the support system they never had. Each episode, we're going to talk to a member of our community doing awesome, inspiring things. Now for your host, Carl Smith.
Welcome back to the Bureau Studios, and I hope that you are warm wherever you are. There's a cold front coming through this country, and even in Florida, we're a little chilly. Now today on the show, we are excited to have Margaret Lee. Margaret is the Director of UX, Community, and Culture for a little company called Google, and she spent 9 years leading the charge at Google Maps. It's a great conversation about how she became a reluctant leader. But before we get into the conversation, I want to share a couple of cool opportunities that you have with our sponsors. Now, Voxy is an amazing company that helps you automate your professional services company. Everything from original estimates to final invoicing to crazy levels of reporting, they run on the Google Cloud. Well, they have a webinar for you next week on best practices for operational visibility and profits. It's a free webinar. Check the show notes for details. Also, so much love and thanks to MailChimp, and they are the best when it comes to any level of marketing platform, not just email. You've heard me say it before, but you know what else? They want to be a partner with you. They want to help you with your business. So check the show notes and find out about MailChimp's partner program. And now, let's listen in on a conversation with Margaret Lee. You've often referred to yourself as a reluctant leader. Mm-hmm. And I would love for you to just talk about what that means and kind of share with us your career from when you started up until when you got to Google.
Sure. Well, I always think of my career almost as a process of elimination, of figuring out, trying things and figuring out what didn't work for me. When I started, I'll go way back, when I was going to university and deciding what I wanted to do, I started out in business school and quickly realized in my freshman year that that was just not for me at all. And I kind of just stumbled my way around the arts and humanities until I started doing some art classes in the School of Architecture at the University of Pennsylvania, where I was. And I just loved it. And it was there that I really discovered design. You know, at the time it was design in architecture, but it really was about problem solving, you know.
Right.
And so that's what I ended up majoring in. But when I got out of school, when I graduated, I realized I didn't really want to be an architect. So I realized that the parts that I really enjoyed was some of the graphical representation of the architecture. I really enjoyed some of the drafting and actually trying to visualize some of the ideas. So that moved me into graphic design. And from there, you know, I did print design for many years until desktop publishing came out. And then I discovered, you know, the Macintosh computer and how powerful that was. And eventually the internet, you know, so it was just sort of this process of discovery that I couldn't have predicted when, you know, I started out at university or even, you know, graduating from university, because a lot of the world was evolving around me.
Yeah.
And like I said, some of it was process of elimination of like realizing, well, this, you know, maybe I'm moving beyond this, but also a process of moving towards what was starting to happen, you know, in the real world around me. So that's basically how I ended up in technology and eventually just going from an individual contributor and a design practitioner to being a design lead, and then you become a manager, and then before you know it, you have like this large organization that you're overseeing. And you know, it's not something I ever planned, let me put it that way. And the reluctant part really comes from, I never really thought of myself as a leader. You know, it wasn't something that I set out to become. And it was somewhat of an organic process that took me a little bit of time to catch up with mentally and emotionally, as well as, you know, in reality, I was being a leader, but matching up sort of my self-perception with that took a little bit of reconciliation personally.
Well, it's so amazing because you and I think started our careers roughly around the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And the capabilities, things that felt like you would never be able to do them. You wouldn't even think about being able to set your own type. which wasn't a thing.
Exactly.
Right? And then suddenly it's just like an explosion of being able to do everything. And the people who grabbed it and went with it suddenly found other people around them. And so I truly appreciate that concept of reluctant leader, because you look around and you're like, oh my goodness, I'm responsible for people. I don't know how that happened.
Yeah. And I think some of it too, I mean, going back to setting your own type, I mean, I did that as well. And I did like literally copy and paste before Photoshop was copy and pasting. I was literally using wax and glue and whatnot. And setting out type for setting and setting out, you know, photos to get airbrushed and whatnot. And, you know, what would take so many people, suddenly you had the power to do on your own was pretty remarkable. And I really enjoyed that part. But at the same time, it was a little bit sad to see people who weren't making the transition quickly, you know, who were hanging on to the, you know, really traditional way of doing things. See them actually get, I don't know, almost like become dinosaurs in the industry, you know, like their skills were no longer viable.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely true. I worked a stat machine.
I had a stat machine. Yeah.
It was beautiful. It was leather and it had this gold trim and all this stuff. And then one day I saw it in storage and it's just sitting there gathering dust. I was like, this is a beautiful piece of equipment and I know we can't use it, but, and so it was similar with some of the people.
Exactly.
Right. There was no way for them to adjust or they were just set and they moved on. So then you go on and you, I know that you worked at TiVo and you worked some other places, and that idea of architecture, I think, is impressive or important, because that's about user experience. You're designing something for people to use, even before we thought in those terms. So talk about what you did with the other companies leading up to Google.
Yeah, leading up to Google, like I said, I worked in print for a long time. First, you know, actually just freelance back in Philadelphia. And then when I moved out to the Bay Area, I worked for this company called Ziff Davis, and they published a lot of basically technology magazines, you know. And through that, I learned a lot about the industry, because I worked with a lot of reporters and whatnot. And, you know, I was surrounded by this information and I found it really interesting. So it was actually through a fellow reporter that told me, he said, you know, there's this company called CNET. You should really check them out. They're, you know, doing this thing with the internet, you know, and for consumers to use. And, you know, we're talking, what, 1995 or 96, somewhere around there. So it was
right
a long
at the
time
beginning.
Ago.
Yeah.
And that's how I learned about the internet, you know, and it wasn't like I was that behind anybody else, but you know, back then I thought, oh my God, I don't know anything about designing for the internet. And it's, you know, you can't control things like you can with print. Everything has to be like this really tiny resolution, you know? So it was interesting, because I went back to this period of like, I have to learn what is in my control as a designer working for the internet versus like in print. It's a whole different kind of context, right? And so I did that for a couple of years, and then I moved to a company called At Home Network, which was at the time like this big broadband service provider. And they were laying down like cable, you know, across the country, you know, really kind of big physical changes in the infrastructure. And my role was working on the content, you know, the front end, right? So and it was basically to showcase the capabilities of broadband. So, you know, we were just creating these like gigantic, basically, you know, image mapped GIFs, but, you know, things that you couldn't do over dial up.
Right.
So that was, you know, a whole other thing. And eventually that there was a merger with this other portal called Excite.com. I don't know if you remember them.
I do.
And this was during, you know, the crazy .com era where, you know, everything was becoming, you know, a .com. And I saw it through the crash. And I actually took part in a layoff where I decided to lay myself off along with a lot of other people, because I was just like, I don't want to do this right now. Like, it just felt really like, to be honest, it felt a little bit soulless at the time. You know, it was just such a frenzy leading up to that point. and then seeing things start to kind of like go under. I didn't want to be part of it. So I took a 3-year break. You know,
wow.
My husband and I started a family. I didn't know if I would get back into the business at all because I felt like 3 years is a long time. You know, the industry is like changing, right? So, and a 9/11 happened during that time. I mean, it was just a really, really intense time. You know, my career didn't feel like the top priority for
right.
me. You know, as we were starting the family and, you know, the world was changing. So I actually had almost resigned myself to maybe not get back into technology. And I was trying to figure out, like, what do I want to do? Like, do I just, you know, focus on the family? Do I take an occasional freelance job? You know, what do I do? And a former colleague from Excite.com called me and said, you know, I'm at Yahoo now. We're looking for somebody to lead the media team. You know, why don't you come in and an interview? And I was like, oh, should I do it? I had such imposter syndrome over this because I was like, I've been out of the game for so long, you know? But I went for it. I went and somehow scrambled together a presentation from like work I had done 3 years previously, thinking like, oh my God, this is just never going to fly. But I went in and I just, you know, it was a case study of like how I led some change, you know, in my prior roles, like design systems and things like that, and how you had to kind of socialize the changes with all the different teams and whatnot. And, you know, basically it was like, oh yeah, that's exactly the kind of stuff you'd need to do here, you know? So I realized like, oh, I guess some of the technologies changed in the 3 years, but honestly, the problems that come with leading teams were not that different than when I left 3 years before, you know?
Still people.
It's still people. It's still like, you know, bringing people along and how do you influence? And
so you get to Yahoo and was that a user experience job?
Yes, it was a director of user experience for what they called was the media team. And so basically that was the content stuff, right? So Yahoo was, you know, very much into the content piece. It wasn't just about, it wasn't just about search.
I got the magazine.
I didn't do the magazine, but, you know, it was things like, entertainment, sports, news, finance, you know, all those types of content, right? So that was the team that I led. And I got back into it. And honestly, it really didn't feel like I was away for 3 years. It really felt like just sliding right back into the same sort of challenges and opportunities, right?
What was it like when you moved from being focused on the family to now being focused on Yahoo? I mean, after 3 years, I mean, that's a huge shift. You're not just joining something, you're kind of adapting something else.
Yeah, it was it was a little challenging. I mean, our son was in preschool. I think he was 2 or something like that when I got back in. And I ended up, you know, we ended up choosing to put him in a preschool that was near the office. So that involved a commute. But it also allowed me to use the carpool lane because he was riding with me. So it did actually, it worked because we could spend some time together in the car, you know, up and down. And, you know, he wasn't that far if I needed to get him. So we made it work. And I think it was good. It's always a question, I think, for parents and particularly mothers, you know, that balancing act. But you do what you have to do, you know, for the good of the family.
I remember reading this research on entrepreneurs and leaders and, you know, people who basically from sunrise to sunset were off somewhere doing something, but they would come home and they would be energized by it, sometimes positive, sometimes negative. But the children of entrepreneurs, people who like are truly throwing themselves, and even if it's not your own company, but just somebody with that spirit, those children want to get out in the world. They're excited to see what is it that takes mommy and daddy out there. Whereas people who have a 9-to-5, but just don't like it, those kids are worried about going out there.
Yeah.
Right. So I bet that transition for you actually opened him up.
I hope so. I mean, it's funny because we still talk about some of the visual influences that he had literally as we commuted. Like, he's an artist now. I mean, he's very much into art and drawing. And so many of his first drawings were of the trucks that we would watch along the road. And just like the music that we would listen to on the commute and whatnot. And both my kids, I have two now, they love coming to visit me at Google. And they talk about, like, especially my daughter, and it's great. You know, she talks about like having aspirations of having a role that, you know, she could be proud of, you know, and I swear I don't push this on them. This is what they've observed. So I'm glad. Yeah.
So you get to Google.
Mm-hmm.
And what's that transition like? When was that when you got to Google?
I got to Google in 2007. So I was at Yahoo, I think, for about 3 years. At TiVo for a really brief time before I made the switch to Google. I just, you know, for whatever reason, TiVo wasn't the right fit for me. You know, honestly, I just kind of felt like the challenges at the time that I was working at TiVo, they weren't of the scale that excited me personally. And, you know, it's really important for me to be highly motivated every day when I go to work.
Right.
That's just how it is. Like, I have to be super motivated and I can't feel like it's not going to be exciting. So I think actually that's a piece of advice I give a lot of my mentees is, you know, if you know that something just doesn't feel right, it's better to kind of call it early than to try to work it every which way. If in your heart, you know, something's not right, you know? So, but when I got to Google, it was really interesting because even though, you know, it's very similar to Yahoo and Excite before that in the sense that it was a large company, you know, I was joining an internal UX org. It was a product development team that, you know, the three-legged stool of UX PMs and Eng, you know, a lot of parallels. It wasn't unfamiliar, but the culture was so different than Yahoo was or Excite before that. Very, you know, everybody had a sense of ownership for being responsible to the user, which, to be honest, was very different than Yahoo. Yahoo is much more of an MBA-driven PM culture, and Google was much more of a, you know, engineering type PM culture. Like, the PMs at Google at that time all had computer science degrees, and many of the user experience folks also had computer science degrees. I did not have a computer science degree. And when I got there, it was right as the company and the UX team was transitioning from being a very flat bottoms up culture where, I mean, literally people would have like 100 direct reports, right?
Wow.
Because it would be so little management, right? And I came in as a manager. So I was like this kind of pariah, like, who, what? You're a manager? You're not going to be hands-on designing? And I was like, that wasn't what my understanding of coming to this role was, you know? So it was an interesting time. Yeah.
And so when you came in, what was it that you worked on right away? Like, what was your challenge? What was it that got you motivated, like you were talking about?
Well, that was the other interesting thing was when I came in, I thought I was going to be working on search because that was what my understanding from my last conversations with my, you know, my hiring manager was at the time. But I showed up and she says, oh, no, you're going to be working on the client team. And that at the time was things like desktop and toolbar. And right now, really, client basically evolved to Chrome, the browser.
Okay.
And I was like, wow, that's really interesting. That's like a space, you know, I really wasn't that familiar with. But that was very typically Google, where it was like things changed all the time.
Yeah.
Like, you just had to be flexible and dynamic. So, yeah, the things that got me motivated was just I had to learn a really not just a new culture, but, you know, this domain space of, you know, desktop and toolbar and, you know, a new browser and whatnot was very, very different than working on content and media like I had at Yahoo. That was more kind of my familiar zone, working designing for content, you know, and this was working designing for like software, basically. But it was a good, it was really good because, I mean, you know, the industry was heading towards building more apps and whatnot and heading towards mobile than it was just designing for more content. You know, that became more of a, you know, that wasn't as challenging anymore, right? So that was great. And then eventually I raised my hand when the manager, the UX manager for Google Maps stepped away and it left a hole. And when I saw that, I was like, oh, that sounds really interesting. Hey, I'd be willing to cover for that because I feel like the role that I have now, it's, you know, I can handle both. And then eventually that became my full-time role, you know, so because I was really interested in Google Maps at the time. So, but that's kind of how Google is. You can really be dynamic and you can sort of shape your destiny as much as anybody else there.
So how long were you on the Maps team? So you got there fairly early?
About 2007, yeah. So, I mean, I raised my hand like within a few months of landing there and it really became like my main role, even though right. I started in one role. It was pretty easy to transition that to somebody who really understood that space better than I did. I mean, I kind of recognized, I was like, I could do this, but it's probably not the best fit for me. Whereas I felt like a passion for working on Google Maps that just, you know, it was clear to me, you know, it was just one of those gut feelings, like that's what I want to do.
So what were some of the challenges when you get to Google Maps and you, I mean, was the plan to map the world? Was that kind of the overarching plan?
Well, yeah, I mean, this was 2007. And by the way, I worked on Google Maps for about 9 years, so for wow. quite a while. And at the time, it was one of the first, I think it was a breakthrough that you could actually pan the map, right? And remember, this is before mobile. And you could actually like pan the map. And, you know, you didn't have to, I think MapQuest was the biggest mapping product back then. And, you know, you'd have to kind of click to move the map, right? And this was just this like very intuitive, you know, panning thing. And right around that time, Street View was a 20% project for some engineers and one designer. And so at the time, that was super interesting because it was one of those things where nobody knew what it would be for, right? It was like, okay, so you can, you know, stitch all these photos of the street together and then, you know, pan through it in your browser, but why would you want to do that? At the time, it really was unclear what would become of this thing. But, you know, fast forward, can you imagine not having Street View when you're doing things like travel planning or, you know, real estate searches or, you know, there's so many must-haves with Street View now.
It's one of those things where, like, coming through it, like MapQuest was part of that evolution, but my teenage daughters, for some reason, The Office, the American version of The Office TV show, came back into vogue. Like everybody was watching it. Mm-hmm. And I came home one day and my oldest, 16, she looks at me, she goes, "Dad, do you know what MapQuest was?" And I was like, "Yeah, it was kind of like Google Maps for Google Maps." She's like, "Why did everybody print them out? That makes no sense." And I was hilarious. "Well, it wasn't Google Maps. It was you didn't have any way in your car to, yeah." So, but for somebody looking backwards, it makes no sense.
I know.
They can't fathom it.
Yep.
On any level. So you're with Google Maps for 9 years and then you started at some point to envision like a new group.
Yeah, it was, I was on Google Maps for 9 years, which was great. I loved working on Google Maps because it was just this endlessly fascinating problem space that was always evolving because the technology was evolving, you know, iPhones came out and then we had Android. So like suddenly you go from desktop to like the map is in your hand out in the real world when you really need it, you know? To things like suddenly have Street View and then like local search is integrated with maps. So So I stayed on maps for 9 years because it was just so fascinating. I mean, you asked me before what motivates you to get up every day. There was so much to do. There really was. And, you know, when I started it, it was, I think, two or three designers, you know, and one of them was like on at 20% or something. So it was a super small team. And when I finished 9 years later, again, it was so interesting, and I could have kept working on it, but it kind of felt like, because I had grown the org to about 60 or 70, I can't remember exactly how many it was by then, and was much more a diverse set of functions, you know, by that time. And, you know, it wasn't just like generalist designers anymore. It was designers, researchers, motion designers, visual designers, et cetera. I felt like I had started to repeat the process every year of, you know, planning and hiring, you know. And even though the problem space was always changing, I was getting farther and farther removed from it, you know, because it was about the org more and more than, you know, my involvement in the product design piece.
Right.
And so I just felt like, you know, I think I'm ready to do something different. And I do think that that's an important thing to realize as well, is when you just, like, it's like playing the stock market, right? Like, when are you kind of at, you feel like you're still feeling like at your high, and know that and step off before it starts to feel like you're going down in terms of your interest. And so I was talking to my very enlightened boss, who's still my boss, and just saying, you know, I think I want to give you a really long heads up so we can plan this together. Like, I think I'm going to leave because I think I've done this enough times that it's, somebody else probably will bring, you know, fresh enthusiasm to it. And the commute was also killing me because it was just getting, you know, the Bay Area traffic is notoriously bad. And I was starting to crave a little bit more work-life balance again as my kids were getting older, you know? So I was saying, like, let's plan in about a year. I'm going to be stepping off. So, cause it takes a while to find leaders and to, you know, have that whole, courtship and whatnot to bring them in. So, just during the course of that early conversation, he encouraged me to think about, like, what would you do if you could do something else? And so I kind of wrote something up and proposed it. And he said, that would be great. Let me kind of, you know, socialize this to a few other stakeholders and let's see. And, you know, it was like, it was almost suspiciously easy, but that's what I'm doing now. And that role, you know, something I had to think of something that I felt like I could add value to the company, you know, while balancing my life in a way that, like, made it possible, right? Like, I didn't want to just kind of go from one high, you know, demanding role to another. Like, it was important that I recognize my need to spend a little bit more time with my family, which meant not commuting. So that role is basically looking after the community and culture of the global UX org. That can mean so many different things. And what I proposed was, there's so many things that I do on the side and that other people do on the side, you know, 20% or whatever, because no one owns it, you know, but it needs to be done. It can be something as pragmatic as, can somebody please work with staffing on evolving our job descriptions or our hiring, you know, interview questions and rubrics, or, you know, internally our ladders, our job ladders, performance criteria, things like that, what's our external community presence look like? Can we coordinate, like, what types of sponsorships or speakers and narratives that we want to have out there? Because, you know, historically, we just never really had anybody coordinating that, right? And because the company had scaled to such a point, I mean, we're almost 3,000 UXers at this point, which is enormous. Because when I started 2007. I think it was just over 100.
That's amazing.
Right. So this is, yeah, it's a really large organization. And when you're kind of organized by product areas, it gets at that scale, it gets harder and harder to have that cohesion, you know? So outside of working on actual product, there's a great need for the UX community to, you know, have somebody looking after it as an organization, you know, representing it on many different levels. So, you know, we do everything from, I mean, we don't do everything. I shouldn't say we do everything, but we do a wide variety of things that otherwise kind of used to just be hit or miss or catch can, depending on who would raise their hand to take care of something. And it still requires a lot of volunteers, but now with me and my very small team, we can at least coordinate it. We're a central point of contact for a lot of teams that need some type of representation or partnership, you know, so we partner with the staffing team, we partner with like the leadership, the learning and development team. We partner with UX leaders. So it's filling a very clear need.
Now, when you were starting out a couple of years ago, I think you told me there were three people.
Yes.
Who are gonna be there. So what's the makeup of the team now?
Now we're six people.
Whoa, you know? You've doubled.
So we've doubled, you know.
That's enormous.
Yeah, it's enormous. But I think what we've gotten better at is scaling through others, you know. So,
okay.
Because even if we got to nine people or 12 people, right, when we're talking about, you know, dealing with the population that we have, I mean, it's just a lot of people. What we really need to kind of do is to figure out, okay, there's only so many actual programs that we would outright own and drive. And we do, you know, have a few of those, but really where the impact is going to come is through influencing through other orgs. So we have a lot of focus on that. I have people who are very versatile, right? So they might have come from the UX, like a UX design background, so that they know what some of the challenges are firsthand. And I think that's what made my role something that could be done, is because I've lived it. So I understand what the challenges that UX orgs have. And then I have several program managers. So people who can really help coordinate and drive, but all of them have to have an understanding of like user empathy, because really it's a design problem. It's just right. An organizational design problem instead of a product design problem. So I really look for people who have that really flexible and open mindset that can understand opportunities, needs. I mean, it really is like being a designer in the product design space, except for people.
Yeah. So I'm curious, with a group that size within such a amazingly huge organization, do you have your own vision? Do you have your own like mission, mantra, something like that for the group?
Yes. I mean, when we first started 2 years ago, the three of us, you know, we basically kind of did a little design sprint on just the opportunity space and, you know, auditing what are some of the types of programs that might fall in this kind of new organization, a new program. And we quickly converged on sort of three thematic areas of focus. The first was knowledge sharing, because that's can be a challenge when, you know, the UX org is decentralized and reports into, you know, various product streams. You know, how do we share knowledge across? Because there's a lot of, you know, duplication of efforts when people don't know what's going on, right? And like, oh, this has been solved before, yeah. You know? So that was one area. And the second area was community. You know, how do we actually foster community? Because we saw that people tried to do this on their own if they couldn't figure out a way to make it happen. So we initially focused just on internal community. How do we build internal community, you know, like at many different levels? But we've also started to focus on what's our role in the community, in the industry. So really looking at how we exist externally as well as internally, you know, as a UX community. And then the third work stream was everything people focused in terms of, like, you know, talent is kind of what we call it, but it's everything from how do we attract the best talent in the industry, but also how do we develop the talent once they are in Google? So how can we ensure that people have a long and, you know, healthy career within Google? So it's like knowledge, community, and talent, but really, like, if you look at any one of those, there's so many different sub work streams that can happen. And a lot of them overlap too, you know, they're not just like in one or the other, because they're all about people as well. We have one of our big flagship programs is actually coming up in about a month. It's called UXU or UX University. And it's our big internal conference that we hold once a year. And the whole entire UX org is invited, you know, to fly in and partake. It lasts for about 4 days. And it's a peer-to-peer education experience. So we have lots of people proposing courses and sessions. So they, like, you know, they want to teach their skills to other people, and then people sign up. We also have keynote speakers. We have an internal keynote this year. It's Ivy Ross, who's the VP of design for hardware, and she's fantastic. I love her, super inspiring.
Yeah.
And our external keynote that we have is Debbie Millman. So she's does the Design Matters podcast. So it's really great. It's super fun. I love it. The community loves it. It's an opportunity for us to all come together, learn from each other. It's the type of thing that, you know, that's the kind of thing that motivates me to do this. So yeah, that's just one example of what we do.
I have to say, you know, the turnover in huge tech companies, like you look at Uber's got the worst of it with like 1.2 years. And then the whoever rates out the absolute best is like around 7 years. And when I was looking at it, you know, Google is in the top quarter with like 3.2 or 3.3 years. And for you to be there for 11 years, it got me thinking, like, you're in the perfect spot, right? Because if you're looking to grow that culture and make it that place where people can stay and want to stay, well, you've been shown the way, because every time you raised your hand and you did something new, and it just feels like you couldn't be in a better place right now.
You know, I don't think it's just me. I think it's, you know, Google does have that culture because there is so much to do that if you say, hey, I see a need for somebody to address this, like, a lot of times you'll get somebody that says, yes, I will invest in that. I mean, not, you know, timing does play somewhat of a factor, but it's something I encourage. You know, I do a lot of mentoring, and I tell my mentees, you know, if you see something that you really want to do, at least try to figure out how to propose it, right? Like, at least make the effort and don't just assume you can't do it, because you never know what's going to come out of it. You know, it might not be the exact thing that you propose. It might be something else, or it might not happen right then. But when the time is right, someone will remember that, you know, you had proposed it before. So I feel very lucky to have been able to propose things or raise my hand and, you know, have people say yes. But I don't think it's just me. You know, I think it's something that we all should feel like we can do. And it has brought me out of my reluctance to leave, because it made me realize, no, it really did make me realize, like, oh, you know, it's, I don't know, it doesn't, leadership doesn't have to just be one way, you know, it can look like a lot of different, it has a lot of different faces, you know.
I just have to thank you so much for coming by the podcast today and hanging out with us on The Briefing. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you, Margaret.
Oh, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
And for everybody listening, we'll be back next week, and we'll talk to you then. All the best.